All right, you guys, welcome to the show.
Well, I better adjust this mic to where I can talk into the goddamn thing.
Check one, check two. Welcome to the show. Rats, I'm double booked. Rats, I'm double booked. No chance for two.
Trying to get Jeff K on the show here to talk about torture.
Anyway, Greg Mitchell's going to be on the show today. Our good friend Greg Mitchell. Boy, it's funny, you know? I have as signposts on the road of my life, my annual Hiroshima interviews with Greg Mitchell. It's one of the things that I can look back on who I am and what I've done and where I'm going and which house I was doing the show from at the time. And it's already Hiroshima Day again. Over and over and over. It feels like, and I know this happens to everybody as you get older. Time, it's not so much the theory of relativity as the theory of comparability or comparability. Yeah, comparability. There's the word I'm looking for. Nice vocabulary in my brain there. The longer you get, the more skewed your bell curve, man, or your grade curve, you know, for looking back on previous time measurements. So in other words, it used to take a long time to get from one August to the next. And now it seems like my life is just an endless list of August Hiroshima interviews with Greg Mitchell. Is it that time again already? I guess it is. Well, geez, if the anniversary of the Gulf of Tonkin fake incident was 2 days ago, I guess it must be the anniversary of the Hiroshima bombing. Eric Garris and I were joking about we could put out an antiwar.com calendar that would have so many anniversaries of horrible things that happened every day of the year. Have more than one atrocity per day. 365 days a year. Let's count them up. By the way, speaking of the Gulf of Tonkin incident, Gareth Porter is going to be on the show tomorrow or the next day. He got caught up today because he's got a new piece coming out for... Oh, I guess I'm not supposed to say. He's got a new piece coming out. And so he's working on that, getting that taken care of. But and I wish I'd read his Gulf of Tonkin piece yesterday before I interviewed him yesterday. I would have interviewed him about that. I heard all this crap about the nuclear talks already. So have you. But man, go look at antiwar.com today, and there is an incredible piece by Gareth Porter, author not just of Manufactured Crisis about the Iran fake nuclear scare, but author of Perils of Dominance, a history of the Vietnam War that was a game changer among official Vietnam War historians. Some of the new ground that he broke in his scholarship there. And one of the stories that Gareth breaks in his book Perils of Dominance is that after going through all the relative files at the LBJ library, etc., he has determined that Robert McNamara lied to LBJ about the Gulf of Tonkin incident. And in fact, lied to him about another incident shortly thereafter, about a week or something later, and that LBJ even called him on it and said, yeah, but that's what you told me about the Gulf of Tonkin 2 weeks ago, kind of thing. And anyway, so according to Gareth, we have a problem with our hindsight where we look at the horrific crimes against humans. Never mind all this collectivism. Humanity as a whole, his crimes against the people of Vietnam who had the natural born right to live. We look at it like, well, the same cynical SOB who murdered all those people is the same cynical SOB who lied us into war. And in fact, I believe that was always even Daniel Ellsberg's interpretation. As you may know, chapter 1 of Daniel Ellsberg's book, Secrets, is about, and you can read the whole thing at my website, actually, at scotthorton.org/fair use. scotthorton.org/fair use. You can read his chapter 1 of the book, Secrets, where he talks about it was his first day on the job as Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Lying Us Into War, and he showed up at the Pentagon, and the teletype started spitting out, "Oh my God, we're being attacked in the Gulf of Tonkin." So he was sitting there furiously reading the teletype coming over the printer there. At the same time, he knew for a fact the exact same information was being passed to the Secretary of Defense at the White House. And so he tells, Ellsberg tells the whole story of, you know, his time at the Pentagon there, the day of the Gulf of Tonkin so-called incident, and how quickly they knew that it was a false alarm. It wasn't that they had staged the whole thing. It was actually that the sonar man was the new guy, and he confused the sound of his own propeller for that of incoming torpedoes. And finally, after they had successfully dodged 14 torpedoes, the captain of the ship said, "You know what? Somebody go wake up the other sonar man. Let's find out what the hell is going on around here." Anyway, I'm off on the tangent. Point is, Gareth says it wasn't LBJ. I mean, LBJ decided to go ahead and ask Congress for the Gulf of Tonkin resolution and went ahead and did start all the bombing campaign in the North and all that. But Gareth Porter is making the case that the national security state and the Secretary of Defense, despite the express wishes, and you can read the article for yourself, despite the express wishes and position of the President of the United States, took an insubordinate policy of forcing him into it anyway. Of doing everything they could to force the war onto LBJ. Now, I do not believe that Gareth Porter subscribes to any mythology about any political leader at all. I don't think he's an apologist for LBJ any more than he's an apologist for George W. Bush or Barack Obama. He never has been. He's just a reporter. So this isn't like, oh, some LBJ partisan defending his dear leader's honor or some crap like that. This is much more an indictment of the system where the national security state, even by 1964, had grown to such an extent that the express wishes of the, you know, first of all, he inherited the presidency, but then he stood and won an election on his own in 1964. And what Barry Goldwater's ass, by the way. And so as far as a president could ever have a mandate from the people, LBJ was a popularly elected president who had the authority, the unquestioned authority, never mind the law, but, you know, by the mandate of the people as well, to tell the military no. To tell the national security state, no, listen, I know you guys want to shoot your guns. I'm just telling you, forget it. But that wasn't good enough for them. Basically, that's the story that Gareth tells, and I'm willing to buy it coming from him. I haven't read the book, honestly, Perils of Dominance, but I read the article, and I thought, wowee, man. And you know what? I believe that when I spoke with Gareth about this in Washington, D.C., at this Council for the National Interest Foundation symposium on the special relationship between America and Israel, I got a chance to talk with Gareth there. And I believe he said that after making his case that he convinced Daniel Ellsberg as well, and that Ellsberg had officially changed his mind and adopted Gareth's position, that it was McNamara, the Secretary of Defense, who didn't just lie to the people, but lied to the President of the United States to get us into the war in Vietnam. Really something else. And again, Gareth will be on the show tomorrow or possibly Friday to discuss that. So that'll be a hell of a thing. Anyway, coming up on the show, Greg Mitchell will be here to talk about Truman, the Butcher of Asia, and Dean Ahmad from the Minaret of Freedom on the War on Gaza. We'll be right back. Hey, Al Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. and they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Robertson at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. Holy crap, what is this? At Gawker, the CIA must tell the truth about my rendition at 12 years old. Wow. This debate is very personal for Khadija Al-Sadi, who at 12 years old was rendered from a London suburb to Libya in a joint CIA-MI6 operation in 2004. Her father, an opponent of Libyan dictator Colonel Muammar Gaddafi, was the main target of the operation. The family accepted a settlement from the British government in 2012 for its involvement. Yeah, I know, it's hard to keep track of whether the Mujahideen or Gaddafi are the good guys in Libya sometimes. So I think first Mujahideen, then Gaddafi, then Mujahideen again. I may have left out a pro-Gaddafi back in the first place there somewhere. Yeah, there you go. That's the lawless torture program. Going after 12-year-olds there. Better make sure Garrus has seen this. Just broke at Gawker.com. Holy crap. Maybe I could interview that person. All right. Anyway, it's the show. Hang on. I'm going to swallow some coffee here real quick. Oh. That's good. Hey, buy some coffee from Darren's Coffee, would you? It really is good. Here's the problem. If you guys don't buy a bunch of coffee from Darren's Coffee, then that means he's going to stop sponsoring the show, because what's he going to do? Lose money on sponsoring the show? And then I'm going to have to switch back to Walgreens, Folgers. Nasty. And I'm now spoiled rotten because I'm on my third bag of Darren's Coffee. This is the Ethiopia roast here. And, man, I don't want to have to go back to Folgers. So, buy some Darren's Coffee, would you? It's two R's and an E-N. Although, I don't know if the other URLs redirect yet or what. Google it, man. Darren's Coffee. They'll correct your spelling if you spell it wrong. Anyway, buy some coffee from Darren's Coffee. And if you use the promo code SCOTT, the shipping is free. So, you might hear the ad. I need to change the ad. I'm so far behind things I gotta do. The ad says save $2. That's a lie. The truth is you save more than $6. You get free shipping. And actually, I think a couple of people had a problem. I went and talked with Darren. We worked out the bug in it, and I verified the promo code works myself. I think there was a bug. A checkbox needed checking or something, but now it's all good there. So darrenscoffee.com, promo code Scott, you get free shipping. And so now check it out. I mean, this guy, he's really bending over backwards to help out here, because free shipping, if you get one bag, it's like $6, because he's still got to pay for the box that it comes in and all the time it takes to take it to the UPS and whatever the problem and however much they charge. And so, but if you get one bag or if you get 10 bags, it's still free shipping. So you could really save a lot of money on even, you know, expensive good coffee. It's not that expensive. It's the same as the good stuff at Walgreens. But free shipping if you use promo code Scott, and you help support Darren and his awesome new libertarian business, and you help support my show, where I cover foreign policy from a libertarian view for the most part. And sometimes I don't talk good. All right, so here's the thing. Talked with Jeff K. Jeff K. will be on the show to talk about torture today. In fact, I better take this rendition at 12 article, and I better put it in my Jeff K. torture section here. Where'd it go? No, there it is. Here's my Jeff K. and the torture section here. Make sure that goes together there. I hope you guys are using TabKit, too. And I don't know why you get the TabKit highlighter separate. I don't care. Maybe it's even a CIA plot to break into my Mozilla or something. I don't know. But I don't care, because the TabKit 2, second edition. TabKit second edition. And the highlighter. Well, for me anyway, and I always have at least, you know, I won't even exaggerate.
I'll say always I have at least 25 or 30 tabs open, oftentimes many more than that. And what you can do here is you can right-click and say group tabs from here to current and color code them all. So for me, that means I have my Iraq section. It means I have my Hiroshima section, you know, today, my NSA police state type section. I have my torture Senate report, etc. section here. Yeah, man, so you understand what I mean. And they're all stacked up on the right side of the Mozilla there instead of across the top. And in case you didn't know, this is my actual service to humanity here. It isn't the foreign policy coverage. It's recommending TabKit 2nd Edition to Mozilla users. It's the most wonderfulest thing ever. So, let's talk about Afghanistan. Of course, we've got, Iraq and more than enough Gaza news to coverage and all these things here. But I wanted to point out these two stories out of Afghanistan this morning. Afghan civilians killed in airstrike by American-led coalition. This is from the New York Times. Kabul. An airstrike by the American-led coalition killed at least 4 civilians, including 2 women, Afghan officials said Tuesday. The attack prompted a sharp rebuke from President Hamid Karzai, who has long bristled at the deaths of Afghans in military operations led by foreign forces. The strike took place a day earlier in Shindan district in western Afghanistan after Taliban fighters fired rockets at an Afghan military airbase that also houses coalition forces, said the district police chief. The insurgents escaped on a pair of motorcycles. A short time later, around 7 p.m., a coalition aircraft targeted 4 people on 2 motorcycles. But those struck were civilians, not the Taliban fighters who had fired the rockets. Hey, close enough for government work, right? I mean, yeah, this was somebody's son and daughter, but life is cheap in the Orient and all that crap. I know, the only excuse we have for killing these people is that we love them so much we're trying to build a wonderful society to protect them from extremists who might kill them. That's the only excuse that our government can come up with. But that's okay. There is actually no limit to the number of innocent Afghan civilians that can be killed to accomplish this project. Am I right, everybody? In fact, the United States of America could kill every last Afghan, man, woman, child, newborn, infant. We could explode them all with cluster bombs, tear their bodies apart with shrapnel to death, all of them. As long as we mean well, as long as we're trying to change their entire society by clear holding and building a government in a box for them so that their girls can go to school, then there is no ceiling on the number of Afghans the U.S. government may kill, right? 4 more. Also, an Afghan policeman killed 7 of his comrades in another infamous fragging today. An American general and a bunch of others were killed yesterday. One cop killed 7 other cops this morning. Hey, all, Scott here for Liberty.me, the brand new social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features nightly classes, guides, events, publishing, and so much more. Sign up now and you get the first 30 days free. And if you click through the link in the right margin at scotthorton.org or use the promo code SCOTT when you sign up, you'll save $5 per month for life. That's more than a third off the regular price. And hey, once you sign up, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me. All right, you guys, welcome back. It's hard to choose what to talk about. There's so much to talk about. Here's one thing I want to... Let's talk about Gaza, man. First of all, I want to point out the... all the various, well, I don't know if I can think of all of the various ones, but I wanted to point out that there have been multiple and various calls for outright genocide in the Gaza Strip in the Israeli press, including a deputy minister, which Max Blumenthal explained on the show is actually not that powerful of a position. This guy, Moshe Feiglin or whatever, you know, apparently he's not that powerful of a person, but he has a very impressive sounding title in the Knesset, the deputy speaker. But apparently, you know, doesn't mean he's that influential. On the other hand, the fact that he's whatever the hell a deputy speaker really amounts to in the Knesset, and he's saying it's time to just take all of the Gazans and force march them the hell out. I don't know where. He doesn't really say straight into Egypt, but he's outright calling for their destruction. No doubt about that. There was an article in the Times of Israel that they pulled that was saying, you know, when genocide is permissible, basically is quoted at length and is still available on the Google cache. And the Times of Israel took that down, but they left up another one that was citing the book of Samuel and saying, see, it says here that it's okay to kill men, women, and children because, look, the book of Samuel, blah, blah, blah. So, and there have been more, of course, back before the actual assault on Gaza started. One of the Knesset members had called for the killing of all men, women, and children in the Gaza Strip, and basically paraphrasing, in a sense, the American Indian fighters. She said that even the babies of Palestinian mothers are little snakes. They'll grow up to be terrorists, and so just kill them all. Just like in the war for Colorado, nits make lice, men. So go ahead and bayonet babies. And so anyway, I just wanted to point out that people are crying all the time about Hamas's charter, which is ugly. It was written back 25, 30 years ago or whatever, and it says in there that Israel has no right to exist and shall be destroyed one day and whatever. On the other hand, they had no ability about that whatsoever. That's like me threatening to personally blow up your whole town somehow or something, right? That's a bad example. No one come and SWAT team me. Jesus Christ, I didn't mean it like that. That's like a 5-year-old threatening to beat you up, right? That's what it is. Hamas has no ability to destroy Israel whatsoever. Give us a break. And by the way, all their politicians for 30 years since then have said that, yes, they will recognize Israel at all different times and in writing, too. They'll recognize the Israeli state. That's why Benjamin Netanyahu has moved the goalposts and said, and you have to declare that it's a Jewish state. Even though, of course, it's an 80-20% Jewish state. The other 20% are Muslims and Christians and already live in Jim Crow status, and for the Palestinian Authority to call Israel a Jewish state would be to outright endorse the Jim Crow segregation that exists already inside 67 Borders Israel, which is a bit of a bridge too far. But anyway, they've agreed even to give up the right of return to pre-Nakba Israel. If you just let them have their second Palestinian state. But nope, that's not good enough. They're terrorists for daring to resist. I saw a tweet. I didn't actually see this on CNN, but I saw someone tweeted what they claimed was a direct quote, which, you know, I'll buy that. And it was coming back from the break. The CNN anchor just began the segment with, Israel has been defending itself for the last 3 weeks now, or the last 4 weeks. Which, they're not even just saying, yes, they're attacking and they're killing and they're bombing, but it's in self-defense. But actually, just the explosions themselves are now called defending themselves. Here they are, defending themselves. As the basic assumption and premise for every verb after that. It's incredible, really. And in fact, I think it's so incredible that it's uncredible, and I like to think that a lot of people watching CNN are going, screw you guys. Like, you can just manipulate me that easily, huh? Not everybody who claims justifiable homicide is actually innocent of murder, okay? In this case, as all 7 billion people on the planet well know, Benjamin Netanyahu lied when he blamed the kidnapping of the three boys on Hamas because he wanted to start a war. He deliberately rounded up hundreds of members of Hamas on the West Bank and started missile strikes into Gaza against Hamas targets, killing six Hamas members in order to provoke them from firing a rocket. And then just like always, oh, look, everybody, a rocket. Wham, boo-hoo. History began 13 minutes ago when this rocket was fired, and there's nothing else that you need to know. Never mind the fact that they outright lied to the parents of the three dead kids for 3 weeks, pretending that they thought they were still alive. Can you imagine if Barack Obama did that? Three American soldiers are kidnapped and killed, and he knows it, and the CIA knows it, and the DIA knows it, but they tell the whole country for 3 weeks, that, and including the parents of the dead soldiers, that, yeah, we're going to try to negotiate with Hamas. We know who did it. Oh, and they lie about who they know did it. Because, hey, they have an agenda. Well, we want a regime change in Syria, so come on, let's all pretend Assad did it. That's right, Assad kidnapped the three guys, and we're going to try to negotiate their release. We're working on it. Get your hopes up, everybody. Can you imagine that? That's what the Israeli government did to the people of Israel. That's how they started this war. Was a couple of, everyone agrees, including the Israeli government, admits that there are a couple of rogue guys who are wanted in the kidnapping and murder of the three Israeli settlers. Rogue guys. A lone cell, in the words of the Israeli government themselves. Not Hamas. Oh, but that's okay. Right? I guess if I just walk up to you and shoot you in the face, and then tell everybody, oh yeah, no, he started it, then, hey, what the hell? My lie is as good as anything else, right? Is that how it works? Anyone can now just murder anyone and just... oh, I was standing my ground. I don't know. I just got here and... I pulled the trigger first and... yeah. Anyway. It's Israel that's holding the Palestinians hostage, not the other way around. And the people who told you otherwise, they're lying to you. Either that or they're damned fools who were successfully lied to by liars who were lying to them. And it's an easy enough lie, and I can understand. Hey, look, a bunch of plucky Holocaust survivors have carved out this tiny little country on the edge of the sea, and they're surrounded by hostile forces and all that, except it's just not true. It's just not true. All the Arab states are friends or are helpless in the case of Syria, are no match for Israel in a million years. And it's actually the Palestinians who are penned in to this tiny little strip of land by the sea, surrounded by their hostile enemies, the Israelis, who stole their entire country and penned them in there in the first place. 80% of the people of the Gaza Strip are refugees from what we call Israel. In the first place. That's the truth, contrary to the narrative. That's the truth about who's holding who hostage here. The Israelis already defeated and conquered the Palestinians 50 years ago. And I just mean, you know, the West Bank, 45 years ago. The West Bank and Gaza, the occupation, never even mind the Nakba of 48. But that's fact one for any discussion of the Gaza crisis today. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. This nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone. We are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. And I had an invite out to Brendan O'Neill, but I wasn't able to get a hold of him. But somebody sent me a tweet this morning to an article by Brendan O'Neill. I like Brendan O'Neill. He writes at Spiked Online in Britain. I'm trying to remember. Eric Garris can explain all this. It's a very interesting intellectual pedigree there over there at Spiked Online. I believe they are, it's a British version, so it's going to be different than Americans anyway. But I believe that they are former Trotskyites turned right wing, but very quickly after that turned libertarian. So I know that Spiked Online and Brendan O'Neill opposed all the interventions in the Balkans in the 90s. I mean, if I had to sum up their speciality, it's attacking liberals for being warmongers. And not even from a hard left position, I don't think. I think they're more libertarian than hard left Marxists, but they come from some kind of Marxist background. And anyway, I'm not the expert at who's all, you know, what kind of former Maoist or Trotskyite or whatever the hell, but they're very anti-intervention all the time. But then there's this article here at Spiked by Brendan O'Neill saying there's something very ugly in this rage against Israel. The line against anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism gets thinner every day. And so, well, I don't know. I guess I got to organize my thoughts right now and then spit them out. First of all, at least the first half of the article is about how liberals are such damned hypocrites. Why are you taking out all of your anti-war rage on Israel when you don't have a damn thing to say about Barack Obama killing Syria, killing Libya, killing Afghanistan, killing Pakistan, starting fights everywhere they can, picking fights with the Russians? I don't know if he brings up the Russians. But anyway, you know, here's a guy who always attacks liberal warmongers for being so-called liberal human rights people while actually they're freaking warmongers. And so he's saying, what the hell is it with you liberals that somehow this is okay? You can take out all of your, everything you hate about the West. You can take out all that rage on Israel and never have to criticize yourself. Well, I think he's answering his own question there, right? That explains it. That's exactly, I mean, he doesn't really get right to it, but it's obvious, right? Liberals don't want to attack those who give them their welfare, those who pay for their college, those who they're counting on to take care of their parents for them when their parents retire, those who they think, the state, those who they think are the backbone of the entire society. It's way easier to attack what they think is the backbone of somebody else's society. So if you don't like the right-wing narrative that the foreigner to attack is the Muslims out there or the Russians out there, well, then attack the foreign satellites of your own state and put all of its sins onto them and take it out on them. Okay, fine. I'll buy that as like a Freudian thing or whatever the hell that, like, okay, yeah, liberals are horrible hypocrites. And many of them, it's a broad brush, but many of them didn't have a damn thing to say about, still haven't had a thing to say about Barack Obama's militarism, about this era's militarism. Now, George Bush killing people, that's a sin. Barack Obama, anyway, let's talk about how those dastardly Republicans are going to try to privatize Social Security again or whatever crap, you know? So he's totally right about that. Then another thing that Brendan O'Neill writes about here is that there's been some real anti-Semitism going on in these protests in Europe, and especially in France, I guess. I think he gives another couple examples. But especially in France, there have been attacks on synagogues, and there are people saying, you know, anti-Jewish things rather than specifically anti-Israel things. And he's right about that. And that's, of course, horrible. However, I think the flaw in this thing is he starts to conflate all these kind of weird things together in a way where, you know, everybody, he ignores it. Everybody's an individual. And even if some people at a protest say some horrible anti-Semitic thing, that doesn't even necessarily mean that's what that protest is about or that that view has much to do with the protest at all, especially when it's a time of war, when the Israelis are actually doing something horrible. You know, probably that is the root of what people are protesting about rather than whatever anti-Semitic slogan may have actually, you know, also happened to make it into their protest somewhere or something. I mean, it can't be that easy to discredit a mass of people just because some of them do or say, you know, something wrong. Although taking the whole damn protest over to the synagogue instead of to the Israeli consulate or something, that's pretty off base. On the other hand, it's happening in context. So I'm not saying that the people at that synagogue deserve it whatsoever. I'm just saying that this doesn't happen just every Saturday. This is happening because of the Israeli state waging war and claiming, quite incorrectly, obviously, to represent all Jews in the world, which is completely stupid. If that's true, how come less than half the Jews in the world live there? Right. That's pretty much the end of the argument there. But anyway, so yeah, but no, anti-Semitism is a real problem. And that's one reason that a lot of Jews are opposing what Netanyahu is doing, is that not just is it horrible, but that there could very well be consequences for innocent people around the world based on the blowback from the horrible thing that's going on here. It's not just a horrible thing in a vacuum. It's a horrible thing going on that pisses off. And look, let's be honest here. You know, 100, the reason they named average IQ 100, it was arbitrary. They just called it 100, right? There are a lot of people on the lower end of the bell curve in the world who can't really be bothered to differentiate between who's who and who did what and who didn't. You know, it's ridiculous, but you know it's true that you're always going to have percentages of people who cannot differentiate and cannot discriminate, if I may use that term, between Benjamin Netanyahu, the government of Israel, the people of Israel, and Jews who may or may not have anything to do with Israel anywhere in the world. You know, just like Americans who took out, who still to this day sometimes attack Sikhs for, you know, wearing a turban on their heads when that ain't got a damn thing to do with bin Ladenite style anything at all. You know? But anyway, so I'm not justifying it whatsoever. Don't anybody take me out of context like I'm justifying it. But I am just saying it is true that it's happening in a context. And in a context of the Israeli government, which itself claims there's no such thing as a difference between Jewishness and pro-Israel government policy sentiment. And I forgot how I started that sentence. Anyway, and the consequences that come from that, something like that, how to say? Anyway. Yeah, it's goddamn Benjamin Netanyahu's fault. That's the real point. No. It's mostly his fault. And it's also the fault of the people who then can't tell the damn difference between him and every other Jew in the world. But now I'm so far off on the tangent, I need to get back to Brendan O'Neill, because I think that there's a simpler and much easier explanation, at least from my point of view. I can't account for why liberals are such hypocrites beyond their love of welfareism and the state as their dad and all this kind of crap. But for me, the reason that I'm so hell-bent about Israel is, one, because of their far outsized role in determining American foreign policy in the region, including just making sure that America stays an empire no matter what forever, just so it can be at their disposal, when we don't really have to be involved in the Middle East whatsoever. And the Israel lobby is a colossus in Washington, D.C. It's the most powerful lobby group ever in Washington, D.C., and only to the negative, with no positive benefits for the American people whatsoever. And in fact, the most substantial negative for the American people is that our support for Israel, our government's support for Israel, helps engender terrorist attacks against the United States. And now, if we were talking about, hey, just being friends with nice little Israel was engendering terrorist attacks against the United States, well, screw them terrorists. We don't have to bend to their will or negotiate with them or any of that crap. But that's not what it is. It's American financial and military support for the most criminal behavior of the Israeli government and their permanent state of war against the people of Palestine for decades and decades on end now. That is what helps generate terrorist attacks against the United States of America, from the first World Trade Center bombing in 1993 all the way through today. And that's just a fact. And, you know, I think it was exploited so cynically and people are still so pissed off at that. Now they might forget actually how bad 9/11 was for a minute there. But that's what was going on there, is Mohammed Atta had joined up the war against America because of what America was paying Israel to do to the Palestinians and the Lebanese. That's the truth. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world, all specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. Darren's Coffee. Order now at darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and save $2. Darrenscoffee.com. All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Website is scotthorton.org. You can find all my interview archives there. More than 3,000 of them now going back to 2003. Our first guest on the show today is our friend Greg Mitchell. First of all, you should look him up at Amazon.com. Ah, better yet, at scotthorton.org/Amazon. And then check out Atomic Cover-Up, So Wrong for So Long, Hiroshima in America. A lot more, but I'm trying to flip through all the nuclear ones first. Hollywood Bomb, of course, and then The Age of WikiLeaks and a lot of other ones. Welcome back to the show. Greg, how are you doing?
Hey, Scott. I'm doing quite well. Thank you.
All right, good deal. Very happy to have you on here. Oh, yeah, Truth and Consequences, the U.S. versus Private Man. That's a great one there. Appreciate that work with Kevin Gostola. All right, so, yeah, I have you here because it's Hiroshima Day, and hard to believe it's already that time again to talk about the nuclear explosions over Japan with you, Greg. I believe it was Zora Neale Hurston who called Harry Truman the Butcher of Asia. And, in fact, there's an article today in the San Jose Mercury News by Barton J. Bernstein, who is a conservative from Stanford University, called American Conservatives Are the Forgotten Critics of the Atomic Bombing of Japan. That's kind of maybe a fun little place to start this interview with, kind of the roles reversed from what we would typically think of as the dove-hawk position here in the U.S. today.
Yeah, Bart Bernstein. I've met him many years ago, and he's been quoted in some of my books.
And can you talk about, at the time, some of the conservative critics of the war, even within the military, right? It was not the way I learned about it in fifth grade was, hey, had to be done. What are you going to do?
Right.
If it didn't have to be done, it wouldn't have been done, right? But apparently that was not the consensus at the time.
Well, it was divided. General Eisenhower famously opposed it. Told Truman, Secretary of War, in advance of using the bomb, that we shouldn't hit them with that awful thing, as he put it. Admiral Leahy, who was Truman's top military chief of staff, was against the use of the bomb. General MacArthur later said that we didn't have to use it, although some people think he was upset because he wanted to get in on the kill in an invasion himself. So, but there were other conservatives, David Lawrence, who was the founder of U.S. News and World Report, a very well-known conservative writer and editor at the time, said that, we basically exterminated people. Hundred thousand people from the air. John Foster Dulles, who was then one of the directors of the United Council of Churches, came out against it in the days after the bombing.
Really?
And the United Council of Churches itself came out against it. It was basically with this, I might say, fleeting recognition that we had deliberately targeted hundreds of thousands for death, vast majority women and children in Hiroshima, and almost all civilians in Nagasaki. And so there was a moral outrage. It wasn't, yes, you have all these arguments about it was a terrible war and it might help end the war and there was so much carnage elsewhere, this was just another one. That was all understood at the time. But there also was, for a while, a certain moral outrage over the U.S., where we're supposedly above this. Deliberately did this. It wasn't, we thought we were hitting a military base and we killed 130,000 people. We knew very well what was going to happen. So, but as I've written so many articles and books for 30 years, the official narrative took hold quickly that this was absolutely necessary. There were no alternatives, and you know, it's gotten shaky over time, but it's still pretty much held with the U.S. media, with many historians, with certainly with U.S. presidents. No U.S. president except for Eisenhower has ever really spoken out about it. So it's you know, it's an enduring narrative, but I'd argue it's a very dangerous one.
Yeah. Well, now, you know, yeah, it's one that, well, like I was saying, I learned about it in fifth grade, and I think I was probably lucky that I had a social studies teacher who made it ambiguous at all, that there was really an argument at all about whether it was worth it to do such a horrible thing. But at the end of the discussion, basically, the lesson was, it was our side that did it. And Harry Truman, right. Why, he was a great American president. And so what more do you need to know, really, other right. than, you know, again, he wouldn't have done it if he didn't have to do it,
right.
kind of an argument. And yet, it's funny just what it's almost like all of history is just the lie they told on the news that day, written down permanently, just like the kind of nonsense we hear on TV every day. Right now, if you look at this argument for a minute, it breaks down on even just the unconditional surrender terms. Well
yeah,
they could have made it conditional, and they would have had their peace already.
Well, they did make it conditional after we used the bomb. You know, we let them keep the emperor. That was the main condition. So, no, I think listen, you know, well-meaning people can have a, you know, a full debate on this. So you can say it's not black and white. You know, it's not an easy historical question unless you want to take the strictly moral never kill civilians view. But the point is, and what I've been struggling with for 30 years, is that the official narrative is so overwhelmingly in the other direction. Now, you know, polls are more split. Let's say maybe it's 55-45 people support the use of the bomb. But in the media, that's certainly not true, and in official circles and in the U.S. Congress.
I'm
and
actually
so
impressed
forth.
By those numbers. Could you say that again? 55-35?
Yeah. No, 55-40, maybe 55-40, 45. It's gotten a little more, over the years, there's been a few more people against it. But that's separate from this overwhelming narrative that it was necessary, and that's what I keep, you know, I posted something today that just a couple years ago, John Stewart had the temerity to make an offhand comment on the Daily Show that maybe Truman, maybe shouldn't have used the bomb, maybe shouldn't have used it. And he got so much criticism, he came on the next day and apologized for that, which was, you know, it was kind of sickening. Yeah.
Well, and in fact, I think, Greg, what had happened was someone in an interview had challenged him, well, you know, on the basis of, I forget what they were arguing about, Iraq or something else, and they said, well, so then is Harry Truman also, was that a war crime when he nuked Hiroshima? And Stewart agreed that, yes, that was a war crime. And then the next day when he apologized, he didn't have any explanation for why it wasn't a war crime. He just said, no, of course, that's ridiculous. But without any explanation as to what was ridiculous about it, deliberately blowing up 100,000 civilians. In an instant.
Yeah, well, you know, again, people can disagree on that, but the fact that if anyone, has the guts to really challenge the narrative, they get incredible pushback. In 1995, which was the 50th anniversary, which was really, you might say, the U.S. attempted to come to terms with this. There was massive coverage. Of course, I had a book myself with Robert J. Lifton, cover stories on Time and Newsweek, all kinds of TV specials and so forth. So there was massive coverage of the 50th anniversary. But and almost all of it, although they paid tribute to those who were killed and the survivors and so forth, ultimately, almost everyone came down at the end to, well, it was necessary. The one TV person who ended by concluding differently was Peter Jennings, who did a special on ABC that I think might be still up at YouTube. And so he looked at the historical record, looked at it carefully, talked to experts, and in the end he said, maybe this wasn't such a great idea. He was vilified. People called for his firing. All sorts of nasty things were said about him, and he was the one guy. So you know, you just don't dare speak out too loudly against that narrative.
Yeah, I think everybody should read Catch 22. That'll destroy any mythology about World War II you believe at all. To look through Heller's lens for just a minute. All right, hang on, everybody. We'll be right back with the great Greg Mitchell in just a sec.
Hey, y'all. Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop. Which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. It's Hiroshima Day, so we're talking with Greg Mitchell, who has spent a great many years specializing on the subject of Truman's nuking of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And it reminds me of my favorite quote of Lou Rockwell, which is simply, "Of course, Harry Truman is a monster, was a monster." And he just says it so matter-of-factly. He's so much... better spoken than I am, Lou Rockwell. He just makes it sound that, of course, just really does the trick. He could convince anyone with a simple statement that there's really just no denying it. And in fact, if you go to LouRockwell.com, you can find an article by the great historian Ralph Rako called Hiroshima and Nagasaki, which is just great. I mean, you got to read it. But one of the most important points in there is he says, listen, despite all the talk about however many and the argument about however many American lives would probably have been lost in the invasion. Imagine if the Americans had done an invasion just of Hiroshima and rounded up all the men, women, and children. Like you said, Greg, it was mostly women and children. The men were all off at war. The elderly were there. And what if they had just rounded them up in the center of town and machine-gunned them all to death, which is something, you know, out of what the Gestapo was doing in Eastern Europe in the war with the Russians, that kind of thing, then that would have, there's no question that that would have been the most horrible thing ever, ever. And yet somehow we're supposed to rationalize the atomic bomb. But when you put it that way, then you realize that there really is no justifying this, especially when you're talking about trading the lives of women and children for GIs, conscripted as they were.
Well, you know, the main argument for using the bomb is, you know, it prevented this U.S. Invasion, which would have killed tens of thousands of Americans and many more Japanese. And, of course, there was an invasion planned for later that year. November, I think, would be the first leg, and then the more major wasn't even until, I think, the following March. So this was, you know, several months off. So the argument is that without the bomb, you know, we would have had this invasion. The invasion would have cost all these lives, and ergo, you know, we had to do it. But, of course, that leaves out the argument that maybe something could have happened back in August that would have ended the war without the invasion, which was, you know, quite a ways off. And that's where the argument has to be, although most Americans are not really aware of that. You still, at this late day, you still get the overwhelming you know, response that, you know, it saved lives because we were going to lose all these, you know, and often it's put in personal terms. You know, my father, my grandfather was steaming the Pacific and would have died in this invasion. Mm-hmm. But the point is always, you know, would there have ever been an invasion? Because, you know, without the use of the bomb, since Japan was making half-hearted or full-hearted attempts to surrender, and the Soviets, as we had demanded and they had agreed, were about to enter the war on August 8th, and the Japanese were more terrified of the Soviets than they were of the Americans. And so even Truman had written in his diary a few days earlier saying that when the Soviets declared war, Finny Japs, when that occurs, that's without the use of the bomb. So, you know, again, you don't know exactly how this would have played out. The Japanese may have not surrendered despite having their military was devastated, and now the Soviets were attacking. You don't know. You don't know if they would have accepted our conditional surrender terms if we'd put them forth on August 6th. But there certainly is a good chance of it, and I've just always argued that, you know, when you kill, 120,000 or more in Hiroshima, and, 90,000 or more in Nagasaki, and the vast majority are, women and children, the weight of evidence has to be on your side. And, some of us don't think the weight of evidence is on the side that was really necessary.
Right. And now, there's a couple more things there, too, which is that the reason that they targeted, or isn't it the case, Greg, that the reason they targeted Hiroshima and Nagasaki is because they really weren't military towns, or just barely, and that was why they hadn't already been burnt to the ground. So
right.
They made great target practice.
Right, though they wanted a clean, if you want to use that word, look at what the results would be. And, Nagasaki didn't even have a major base, and Hiroshima had one. And in any case, the bombs were not dropped over the military bases. If you wanted to argue that this was a purely military strike, you'd say, well, we aimed it at this military base on the edge of Hiroshima, and, we didn't know the 100,000 civilians were going to die. But that wasn't even what they tried to do. So you can't even make that argument. Yet, as I wrote a piece today that in the carefully crafted speech that Truman gave hours after the attack, he said, today we have struck Hiroshima, a military base, no mention of it being a city or anything. So, it shows the sensitivity they had for publicity, but not for, stopping them from doing the attack.
Yeah. Well, and then Truman also, when asked how come you didn't drop a third one, since it still took him a couple of more days to surrender, he said, I was gonna, but I just thought all those women and children.
Right. Which, he said, I didn't want to burn up anymore.
He's conceding that, right. Yeah, well, the first two, too, Harry,
Well, that's, and then the tragedy of Nagasaki, among other things, is that it was sort of on the assembly line. No one has been able to find a specific order to drop the bomb on Nagasaki. It was just, Truman gave the okay around August 1st that, drop bombs when ready, and so the Hiroshima bomb was ready, the weather was okay for August 6th, and then no one stopped, Truman. There's no record of someone even having a major meeting with Truman and saying, Harry, should we hold off on the second one for a few days?
It was just strictly assembly line. So, I mean, that's the
assembly line, devastation, so.
That's just incredible. He did not even retain the specific authority per nuke. He just said, "Go ahead and go, guys."
Yeah, well, he retained it, but he didn't exercise it. I mean,
wow.
If we'd had a third, and I think we did have a third one that was ready. But I think the order was probably, went in after the second. I guess if we could have easily. If Nagasaki run had gone off a day earlier, maybe we would have used the third before it was stopped.
Wow. All right, y'all. Greg Mitchell's new book, and it's an e-book, too, available there at Amazon with the rest of them, is Atomic Cover-Up, Two U.S. Soldiers, Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and the Greatest Movie Never Made. And he's got, go to Amazon.com and just search for Greg Mitchell there at Amazon, and you'll find his whole collection of, well, all kinds of different books, too, but a whole collection of books about Hiroshima and how the American population and media and government have handled the issue over all these years and all this great stuff. It's just great stuff. Thank you so much for your time, Greg.
Thanks.
Appreciate it.
Thanks, Scott. Thank you.
And you can find his great blog at Pressing Issues. Pressing Issues. Oh, GregMitchellWriter.blogspot.com. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers. Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders, quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them.
and, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck.
All right, guys, welcome back. A few more things about nukes here. As long as we're on the subject, Daniel Ellsberg likes to phrase it this way. He says, you know that Nagasaki bomb? Hiroshima, that was a uranium gun-type nuke, simple gun-type nuke. They didn't even test it. They knew it was going to work. Blam, it worked. The Nagasaki bomb, that was the one that they tested at the Trinity site there in New Mexico before they dropped one just like it on Nagasaki, and that was the implosion bomb. It's still a fission bomb, an atom bomb. It's plutonium instead of uranium, a very heavy radioactive metal. Plutonium-239. And then what happens is they split those atoms in half under critical mass, and that releases so much goddamn energy that it'll kill 90,000 people in one shot and destroy a whole town. In fact, there's a recent X-Men movie, a Wolverine movie, where they show a recreation of the nuking of Nagasaki, and he lived through it because he's Wolverine and he can live through atomic bomb blasts, I guess. And yeah, that's really something, actually. I'm glad they did that just for, you know, humanity overall having a little bit better picture in their collective unconscious of what that must have looked like there when they did it. But anyway, here's the point. Sorry, it's a long tangent. Daniel Ellsberg likes to point out that the Nagasaki bomb, that implosion plutonium bomb, is now used just as the blasting cap for setting off an H-bomb. You know how you hear people talk about cold fusion? And I'm sorry, I don't mean to be patronizing for people who already know all this crap, but I'm talking people who don't know all the crap. You know about cold fusion, right? Like on Back to the Future, where part two, where he's got Mr. Fusion for the back of a car. Somebody invented how to... figured out how to fuse atoms together at room temperature and get all the free energy in the world out of that, right? That's the holy grail of free energy for humanity forever, cold fusion, right? And in Back to the Future, you can fuse any old thing, I guess, including banana peels and beer cans and whatever, right? Well, anyway, point being that so far, as the scientists have figured out, and the engineers have been able to test, the only way that they can figure out how to do real fusion, where you get more energy out than you have to put in, is at extremely high temperatures. In fact, about the temperature of the surface of the sun. So, that's why they use a Nagasaki bomb as the blasting cap for the super, is because they need to make it as hot as the sun by splitting plutonium atoms in order that then they can fuse hydrogen atoms, the very lightest of elements, that they can fuse those hydrogen atoms together and release that much more energy. And that's what takes your nuclear bombs from tens of kilotons, and that's a measurement of thousands of tons of TNT, being the baseline for how they measure. That's how you take your nuclear bombs, your A-bombs, that explode at tens of kilotons and turn them into supers, hydrogen fusion bombs, thermonuclear bombs that explode in the tens of megatons. And now mostly the point is they want to be able to make them bang really big from really small bombs so that they can fit a lot of small bombs on one missile warhead. And they'll have a bunch of decoys and a bunch of H-bombs all taken off from one ICBM to make it harder for enemies to defend themselves from. And then, so in that sense, you may still be actually dealing in high tens of kilotons from a small H-bomb. But still, they also have the 10 and 20 and 30 and 40 and I don't know how high they go. It's classified, I'm sure. just how high of the tens of megaton range they go. Now, I guess Tsar Bomba, the largest nuclear bomb, thermonuclear bomb ever tested, was, what, 70 megatons? Let me see. Megatons. It was, oh, they say this one was 50 to 58 megatons. So I guess the rest of the biggest ones, smaller than Tsar Bomba, were, you know, are in the tens, 20, 30 megatons. Still, that's enough to kill my entire hometown of Austin, Texas. From Slaughter Lane to Breaker Lane. And your town, too. And the only reason I go on about this, it's not because, oh, boo-hoo, I'm a hippie or something. And it's also not because I'm saying, oh, no, there's probably going to be a nuclear war any day now. Because really, it seems like mutually assured destruction has worked pretty well so far. It's just that so far is the blink of an eye. And so far does not take into account all of the different variations and variables. And no, I certainly don't want a United Nations monopoly on nukes or anything like that. But I do think that it is within the realm of the power of the civilian human beings of this planet to force their governments to abolish these weapons. It is possible. And, I mean, just try to be as objective and mathematician about it as you can. Isn't it just wrong and crazy that we let our government keep these bombs that can be used to kill cities full of civilians? You know, the Daisy Cutter bombs and the Moab bombs, aren't those big enough? Do we really need city killers? It's crazy. And, you know, there's enough mutual economic interest and enough mutually assured destruction between the major powers in the world without nuclear bombs. You know, France and Germany and Britain, they could go back to war with each other like the old days if they wanted, but they'd be losing everything. And that's without nukes. You know, there are conventional bombers and whatever weapons can reduce each other's countries to rubble. And I'm not saying, again, that that makes it impossible, but it just means they have plenty of incentive to not do so already. And here's the other thing. This is not some commie, hippie, pinko position. This is a Reaganite position. George Shultz is behind abolishing nuclear weapons. Okay? Establishmentarian Council on Foreign Relations, former national security advisors, former secretaries of state, Republicans and Democrats and scientists and experts with all the credentials and all the crappy gravitas and whatever the hell in the world you're supposed to need to take somebody seriously, they are behind getting rid of nukes. The only people who aren't are currently serving members of Congress, who got to get reelected and are relying on the nuclear weapons lobby to help pay their way. And yes, there's a nuclear weapons lobby. Well, what do you think? Their entire industry is dependent on the Treasury continuing to write checks. And so, yes, they support, always, they will always believe that America needs nukes to protect the people, because they have to believe that, because that's where they make their money, making H-bombs. But other than the people with the vested interest, those among the elite, I hate that term, those among the powerful in America who actually know a thing or two about this and no longer have a vested interest in going along with the current policy are opposed to nuclear weapons. They've got a push called Global Zero. You might remember they tried to keep Chuck Hagel out of the Secretary of Defense spot. This was one of the accusations against him, was he'd signed on to this. But he's right. And when Barack Obama's lying and pretending like he wants to get rid of nukes, he's right too. And it's got to be done. And we got to figure out how. Right now, there are enough to kill us all.
Hey, I'll Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future of Freedom Foundation. Edited by libertarian purist Sheldon Richman, The Future of Freedom brings you the best of our movement. Featuring articles by Richman, Jacob Hornberger, James Bovard, and many more, The Future of Freedom stands for peace and liberty and against our criminal world empire and Leviathan state. Subscribe today. It's just $25 per year for the back pocket size print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's The Future of Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. Peace and freedom. Thank you.
All right, you guys, welcome back to The Dang Thing here, man. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show. Coming up, I'll be talking with Jeff Kay and Dean Ahmad about torture and Gaza, respectively. All right, this is the part of the show where I tell you about money. I need some. There's no big institution here. FFF does advertise on the show, as does the Council for the National Interest, but I'm not an employee of any foundation or anything else. My needs are few, and I've always been very happy just barely skating by, and that's perfectly fine. But I need enough to barely skate by, or else I gotta go get a different, better job. And what I really need is advertisers. If you want to advertise on the show, you should email me, scott@scotthorton.org. I work real cheap. We can work something out. I'm pretty damn sure of it. But also, you can sign up for 5, 10, 20, whatever you like, monthly subscription donations or just a one-off donation. Any donation, $100 or more, I'll send you a commodity disc because I'm really happy to help promote those things. I think it's really a great idea to have the QR code on the back of your one-ounce silver piece, and then that way you know how much it's worth in real time all the time. Instead of having some face value on there where either you're taking a loss or the shop keeps taking a loss if you try to spend the damn thing. That doesn't make any sense, does it? Right. So there's no face value. There's just a QR code, and it's brilliant. It's the best thing ever. That's why I never liked the Liberty Dollar, was because it had that face value thing on it, and it seemed like somebody's getting screwed there on the arbitrage or whatever the thing, right? I don't know about money, but you know what I mean. But now this is perfect. The QR code commodity disc. It's perfect. You donate more than $100, you get one. If you want. That's at scotthorton.org/donate. I got expenses. I need to meet them. So help out if you can. And that's a hell of a lot better than listening to National Public Radio and listening to them go on and on and pretend they don't suck and promise you tote bags and crap. You got a better job than me, and part of the reason your job is so awesome is because you get to listen to me at your job. So, just think about how bad your job would suck if you couldn't listen to me. Well, there are more than 10 years worth of archives there for you to go back over, but, you know, anyway, you understand what I mean about, you know, new stuff coming out all the time. You want that, right? Okay, good. ScottHorton.org/donate. All right, that's it. Sorry. Change the subject now to Justin Amash, who probably is the best member of the House. I don't know his entire voting record. He may already piss me off a couple of times or something, but I think I like this guy for a member of Congress anyway. He's a young Ron Paulian from the 08 era. I think he was elected in 2010 or something. Anyway, so he was just challenged from the right by a guy named, well, I don't know, from the right. He's a libertarian, Ron Paulian. So that's not necessarily right-wing, but it's more conservative than conservative on things that conservatives are supposed to be good on, like, you know, fiscal restraint. But anyway, so he was attacked by this establishment guy, Brian Ellis. I don't know if you could call it from left or right, but maybe from above. This guy, the challenger, was the establishment guy sent by the Republican Party to get rid of this Amash character they can't stand. And then I just thought this was hilarious, that here he called Justin Amash Al-Qaeda's best friend in Congress and all this. And then check it out. Justin Amash whooped this guy 57% to 43. Double digit whoop ass on this guy, Brian Ellis. And then, so Ellis called to congratulate Amash, and Amash just attacked him and said, "You owe my family and this community an apology for your disgusting, despicable smear campaign."
I ran for office to stop people like you. And on, he went attacking this Republican. And then get this, I love this. I think I like this guy Amash more than ever now. He also mocked former Republican House Representative Pete Hoekstra, who backed Ellis. Quote, "You are a disgrace, and I'm glad we could hand you one more loss before you fade into total obscurity and irrelevance." Ah, damn! Don't mess with Justin Amash. He will whoop your ass in the primaries. He says everyday Americans are taking back their government from the crooks and the cronies, taking back their government from the political class elites. Well, I don't know if I believe in all that, but he certainly would be the representative of the people as compared to his challenger in this case. No doubt about that. I actually heard someone played a clip or posted online a clip of a radio show where the guy is attacking Justin Amash, and he's trying to make him sound like Ted Kennedy or something. Oh, he was against the Ryan budget because he's so liberal. And then Justin Amash calls in and says, "That's such a lie, and everybody knows you're a liar because everybody knows my position is that Ted Kennedy might as well have written the Paul Ryan thing, that it does not cut enough for me at all. So if you're for the Ryan thing, then you're the one who might as well be a Democrat, pal. And how do you like that?" And this guy was left sputtering with nothing. That's the problem with being a liar. It's hard when you get called out. So, oh, I don't know how to fix it. Well, what do I say next, guys? Busted. So I think that's funny that nobody took this guy, Brian Ellis, seriously. And that Justin Amash kicked his ass. And you know what else? Here's the other thing about it, is Amash had just voted, was one of seven members of the House to vote against sending more welfare money to Israel for their Iron Dome, which you could say is defensive, but it's not really, because it's like wearing a suit of armor to a fistfight. It allows them to act aggressively with more impunity. And so here Amash opposed that and still just sailed right on in. Again, a double-digit defeat for Brian Ellis. So that's pretty good. And then speaking of Gaza, this is from Human Rights Watch from 2 days ago. I meant to talk about this yesterday. I guess I kind of referred to it, but I never got back to it. Gaza, Israeli soldiers shoot and kill fleeing civilians. Oh, no. Every time Israel kills a civilian, all you need to know is that civilian must have been being used as a human shield by Hamas. Which they don't go on to argue, because it doesn't make any sense, means their life is forfeit and so it's okay to kill them. They just leave that part out, even though that's the implication they want you to accept. That, oh, well, whatever, we can kill as many civilians as we want in the Gaza Strip because, it's all Hamas's fault. I don't know how in the world anybody falls for this crap. It's so stupid. It's completely ridiculous. But anyway, so here they are shooting fleeing civilians in the back. Does that still count as a human shield? Does it matter that Israel's military establishment is in the suburbs, next to the strip mall, all over the place in civilian-populated Israel? Does it matter that human shield actually is a word that means a thing, a term that means a thing? It means actually using someone as a human shield, you know? Like in The Empire Strikes Back, when that Imperial officer, which is actually the actor that played Boba Fett in his cameo role as an Imperial officer, grabs Princess Leia and holds her in front of him when he's in a firefight with Luke Skywalker. Remember? At Bespin? That is a human shield. When the Israelis tie a Palestinian to the hood of their truck, when Israelis force Palestinians to go into houses first that they suspect may be booby-trapped, when Israeli military forces use Palestinian children and force them to walk down the street in front of them and use them for cover, or hide in civilian houses with the civilians still inside them, when John Kerry makes an old man walk down a trail in front of him on the Mekong Delta to set off any landmines that might be hidden there. That is using a human shield, okay? It's a real thing. It means real things. It does not mean daring to resist while living in an urban area. That's not what it means. Oh, what a surprise! It turned out that the 9 millionth thing out of the Israeli government's mouth for a total of 100% of everything that they've ever said about anything is a damned lie. Isn't that funny how all they do is lie, the Israelis? Why, it's almost as though what they're doing is wrong. And they have to lie to you to get you to want to go along with it, huh? Maybe? Human shields. Get the hell out of here. Oh, John Kerry's Mideast peace talks have gone nowhere. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. U.S. military and financial support for Israel's permanent occupations of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is immoral, and it threatens national security by helping generate terrorist attacks against our country. And face it, it's bad for Israel, too. Without our unlimited support, they would have much more incentive to reach a lasting peace with their neighbors. It's past time for us to make our government stop making matters worse. Help support CNI at councilforthenationalinterest.org. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. Our next guest on the show is Jeff Kay. He's a psychologist in private practice in San Francisco. For more than 10 years, he worked professionally with torture victims and asylum applicants. I guess oftentimes the very same people there. And he has his own blog called Invictus, but you can also find him at Truth Out Alternet and Firedog Lake, dissenter.firedoglake. And his latest piece is Obama admits he banned only some of the CIA's torture techniques. Welcome back to the show, Jeff. How are you doing?
Hi, Scott. How are you?
I'm doing good. Appreciate you joining us today. And so before we get right into this article and the president's recent statement and what all that means and all that, can you first of all just catch us up a little bit on the news for people who haven't been keeping up with this story? There's so much going on. There's been obviously the recent developments in the case of the Senate torture report and their relationship with the CIA and all of that that led to the president's statements. Could you catch us up here real quick?
Sure. Yeah, there has been a ton of politics going on between the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence and the CIA and, of course, the Obama administration or President Obama himself, because after the revelation that videotapes of torture by the CIA had been destroyed by the CIA, the Senate committee initiated an investigation of the CIA torture program, interrogation, rendition, and interrogation program, and amassed 6,000 pages report, apparently documenting things that are far worse than we've even heard thus far. And this is according to Senator Dianne Feinstein, the head of the committee. But it turned out, then there were later revelations that the CIA, back and forth between the CIA and the committee, the CIA claimed that the committee was trying to essentially hack into their stuff. They were able to access something called the Panetta report within the CIA that was looking at the CIA abuse. And they claimed that this was spying done by Senate staffers. The Senate themselves said, no, you're hacking into congressional computers. This is outrageous. It was sent to the Department of Justice, who kicked the football down the field. And just the other day, despite the fact he said that the CIA had done nothing wrong, John Brennan, the director of the CIA, and a longtime national security advisor and intelligence advisor to President Obama, admitted that the CIA had done improper, quote-unquote, investigations of the Senate panel. So all of this is kicking around, and of course the press is up in arms about this. And meanwhile, there is an executive summary of this report that the Senate committee okayed for release, and it went to be looked at by the executive branch, by the CIA, so they could supposedly censor out portions that were too sensitive or people's names, whatever. Mm-hmm. And now the latest dispute is that the Senate has over, big surprise, redacted, overclassified sections of this summary that's put out for that's supposed to be released to the public. As a result, Senator Feinstein has said, you know what, I'm just not going to release even the executive summary at all. I'm going to send it back. You do a better job, redact or censor less of this. And, of course, the headlines just keep rolling. But what it also does is it forms a narrative about what, how the U.S. engaged in torture, what U.S. torture is, what's going to be revealed. That, and underneath this narrative, a lot of the truth about what's really going on is being buried, and that was the purpose of my report.
Mm. Well, yeah, I mean, on one hand, it is being brought back up and sustained in the news cycle, so there is a silver lining to it, but you're right, the focus is not on the actual inhumanity of what was done. We are going to focus on that, but...
Well, one example, Scott, just very brief, is that, you know, the fight right now is all framed as whether or not this executive summary will be released.
Right.
I don't know if you're familiar with the concept of the Overton window, which is if you don't like, we're going to reframe the discussion and make the discussion all about this. And then when you get your little victory, everyone will think, wow, we won, when in fact you lost because the battle was lost in the reframing of the argument itself.
Right.
So in this case, it's still the same thing. The Senate did apparently a really good job of investigation. They have a 6,000-page report. Feinstein announced they are not going to release, in fact, not going to release the 6,000-page report. That's the news story. The Senate is refusing to release their investigation of the CIA torture program. But instead, they were going to release a watered-down executive summary, which is now furthermore going to be watered down by the CIA itself. And the fight now is over how much watered down it will be.
Right.
Will it be the watered down Senate version, or will it be the watered down CIA version? And if the Senate wins, everyone will go, wow, we really got openness. When in fact...
And we're still talking about a summary after all.
Yes.
And levels of redaction. I get it.
And those summaries are never, they always
leave
out.
Well, you know what, though, Jeff? You know, I learned as a kid from my dad about Watergate that it's not the crime, it's the cover-up that gets you. And I understand now why that is. It's because the crime is never the CIA kidnapping and torturing congressmen, right? It's always some third party that's actually suffering. But the cover-up is an affront to the other branch. And in this case, the CIA went so far. I mean... It's funny because I do want to get to the inhumanity of the actual tortures and all. It's so important to explain why and how this is so criminal that there should be something done about it and all that. But at the same time, this is the kind of thing that could, if we had a constitutional republic, this would be the end of this administration for the CIA going so far as to spy on the Senate Intelligence Committee, no matter what their excuse is. I mean, that ought to be absolutely earth-shattering. It's only because the subject matter is torturing people to death that makes it sound like it's just some kind of bureaucratic thing. But that is just absolutely huge.
And
the CIA acting like they are the boss of the Senate Intelligence Committee.
That's because the CIA's ultimate boss, the one who can fire at will, the director of the CIA is President Barack Obama, who is a Democrat. And the Democrats, even in Congress, as incensed as they are not going to make, you know, if President Obama were Richard Nixon, there would be articles of impeachment written by Democrats against Obama. He got on TV, you mentioned that. So Obama came onto television and said, hey, Brennan said he did something wrong, our people tortured some folks, but, you know, we're going to sweep it all under the rug now.
Yeah.
And I stand by my CIA director who hacked into the, congressional computers and tried to derail a torture and a Senate investigation.
Right, and lied to everybody's face about it, too.
Yeah, and then lied to everybody's face. But I stand by this man. I mean, even Nixon, frankly, was not so overt in his defense of the people. Even Spiro Agnew had to resign.
Right. All right. Now, so as long as we're talking about this, what do we know about what Obama knew about the CIA spying on the Senate like this? Anything?
That I don't know what he knew about that.
What did the president know, and when did he know it?
Right. That would be subject for some kind of Senate investigation. But I personally am not as interested in that, and it could go that way. I could certainly foresee, and the Republicans themselves may want to push this. Except the reason you hit on the other main reason, if they go into this, it means that they have to open up a can of worms around torture, and they don't want to do that. They're trying to control the torture story, not open it up bigger.
Right.
And
well, by the way, I think this is a good time for me to mention that yesterday Phil Giraldi, former CIA officer on the show, said he's speculating now, but he thinks that maybe there's something really bad in there that we really don't know about yet, because Panetta reports, so what? Why would they go this far? He thinks there's something new that we are yet to find out in that report somewhere, something big. Something worse than people being tortured to death, you know?
Well, that more people were tortured to death, possibly, that in fact the MK Ultra program never really ended, which is what I particularly believe.
It seems like it was used on Jose Padilla, right? The sensory deprivation and all that?
Well, I think it's part of what's being done at Guantanamo.
All right, well, we're going to pick this up on the other side of this break. MK Ultra and the inhumanity of the Bush and Obama administration's tortures of their captives over the last 14 years. Here, be right back. Oh, I should say again, Jeff K. at dissenter.firedoglake.com.
Hey, Al Scott here. First, I want to take a second to thank all the show's listeners, sponsors, and supporters for helping make this show what it is. I literally couldn't do it without you. And now I want to tell you about the newest way to help support the show. Whenever you shop at Amazon.com, stop by ScottHorton.org first and just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page. That way the show will get a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. It won't cost you an extra cent. And it's not just books. Amazon.com sells just about everything in the world except cars, I think. So whatever you need, they've got it. Just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page at ScottHorton.org or go to ScottHorton.org/Amazon.
All right, y'all, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton, and I'm talking with Jeff K. from dissenter.firedoglake.com. He's a psychologist who's spent more than a decade working with torture victims, and he's been writing for a great many years here about America's torture regime, which continues. As, Jeff, your article here details, the president admitted on August the 1st. I guess before we get to that, though, please finish up what you were saying there before the break about MKUltra. Can you remind people what is MKUltra and what is it that you think remains of that legacy as policy in America today?
Well, MKUltra is just one of the best known of a number of different United States government mind control and programs that were aimed in part about forming forms of interrogation, but also population control, other really dark, crazy, conspiracy-sounding stuff that anybody might write anyone off like myself who talked about, except that it's all documented, or at least it's very much documented. The United States government destroyed many, many records about these programs, but what's left shows us that it was a multi-million-dollar program that touched many different parts of American civil society, including hospitals, universities. Certainly, it was included in military participation, and it had one of the things it did, that's most popularly known for, was the experiments on LSD and the use of using drugs like LSD. You mentioned Jose Padilla, who made that same charge, to control people, to break them down, to make them, or if nothing else, just to make them psychotic and discredit them in the eyes of other people, all sorts of things like this. And at Guantanamo, the only reason I said that is, there's certainly evidence that the CIA had a black site there. The other Scott Horton has written about that at Harper's. And, Jason Leopold and myself have written about the strange use of the drug mefloquine, which prestigious medical group based at Columbia University came out earlier this year and also called for an investigation to the use of that drug on all the Guantanamo detainees. And there are many, many other instances I could go into. But I do want to talk about what Obama said, because it's very important. And it was a moment when, underneath all the sound and fury surrounding the CIA report, a piece of what's underneath all this emerged for a moment when Obama admitted, and what he said, quote, is that after I took office, one of the first things I did was to ban some of the extraordinary interrogation techniques that are the subject of the CIA report.
I'm sorry for laughing, but isn't that just amazing, the President of the United States, that he would just kind of say it that way, so thoughtlessly, just let that slip that way?
You know, I'm a psychotherapist, and I know very well that when people are under pressure, the truth slips out. Interrogators know that, too. And this is an instance of that. And what I do in my article at the Dissenter that was out the other day was to show, because I've been working exactly on documenting this, and I'm not alone in this, by the way, but unfortunately, even those who have worked on this issue, such as the Constitution Project, who wrote about the use of torture in the Army Field Manual and put out a huge report on it last year, got a lot of press coverage, or, you know, groups like Physicians for Human Rights or Amnesty International or Center for Constitutional Studies, Constitutional Rights, all of them and others have written about how the Army Field Manual, which President Obama made the gold standard for interrogation practices by both the CIA and the Department of Defense when he came into office in January 2009, which is what he's speaking about in that quote, in fact, allows all sorts of different torture techniques, including the use of isolation, sensory deprivation, sleep deprivation, drugs, manipulation of diet, manipulation of the environment, use of fear, use of something called futility to break down people psychologically so they feel helpless. I mean, these are torture techniques. They're not waterboarding, but they're forms of psychological torture techniques that were well studied and, in fact, was the result of the CIA's MKUltra program, mm-hmm. which was formalized in a torture manual which the Baltimore Sun got in the late 1990s and revealed, called the QBARC manual, mm-hmm. which showed exactly how they use these same techniques to break people down.
Right.
And but none of that's
talked
about.
Sleep deprivation, that's not just psychological. I mean, that is a physical assault as bad as beating somebody, really.
Yes. In fact, there is. It's good to point out that the distinction between physical and psychological forms of torture is a very blurry one. And sleep deprivation is a good example. So, frankly, is isolation.
Yeah.
Because putting a person in a sensory deprived environment actually has negative effects on the nervous system and the brain itself.
Right.
It can be
measured. You know, the thing about mm-hmm. this, too, Jeff, is, you know, I've been covering this all along since even still during the Bush years. It was all as above board as a torture program could be, that if you're going to pass the Detainee Treatment Act, Cheney insisted, first you take the CIA out of it, and secondly, if you're going to bind the military to the Army Field Manual, then we are going to rewrite Appendix M of the Army Field Manual to allow as much of this stuff as we think we can possibly get away with. And that's exactly what they did. And so I guess, you know, it's not like they reveal the details of how they apply this stuff to their victims at Bagram all these years on a regular basis or anything. But it's almost like the way they lied us into war with Iraq, where they announced, we're about to lie you into war with Iraq for the next year and a half. Get ready. Here it comes. And then they did. It's the same thing here. Oh, yeah, we got a Appendix M. It's our go ahead and keep torturing free card, you know, and get out of jail free card. And they announced that even before Obama took office. And then he, from the very beginning, on the very first day, he made it clear in his statement that he was going to continue applying Appendix M.
Yes.
As you just
said.
And the
whole Army Field Manual, Appendix M is the worst part, but does include, you know, that, for instance, the allowance of use of drugs is a major part. It is in the main text of the Army Field Manual, not Appendix M. The use of fear and phobias to manipulate detainees is in the main part.
And did they rewrite the whole thing, or did they rewrite?
They rewrote the entire thing.
Oh, okay.
And they did, and in doing so, they did things such as they removed the old Army Field Manual had a prohibition against sleep deprivation. Guess what? That disappeared from the main text of the new Army Field mm-hmm. Manual. The old Army Field Manual had a prohibition against the use of stress positions. This is making people kind of crouch or be in some bizarre position and have to stay that way for hours on end.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned in your article, too, and I'm sorry we're so short on time, but it's really important, Jeff, that you mention Scahill's work on Somalia and their so-called national security agency that they have there and the prison that they keep in cooperation with CIA and JSOC. And I hate to give any credit to Eli Lake, but he reported another prison just like that up in Puntland, too. So that's a whole new huge thing there.
Yes, so exactly. But these things, you remember them, but the mainstream coverage that's going on right now doesn't remind the reader of that. So it becomes isolated as if it's all about this issue. And over and over, what the press does is it cuts out the history And so it makes it all sound like what's happening now is just about an argument over some redactions in a report.
Right.
When it's really about a decades-long use of torture by the U.S. government.
Right. And of tens of thousands of people, not three or four people were waterboarded, but tens of thousands of Afghans and Iraqis were treated without any kind of benefit of the so-called laws of war for years there. That's what people got to remember. All right, I'm sorry we're out of time. Thanks so much.
Okay, thank you so much, Scott.
Jeff K., everybody, dissenter.firedoglake.com. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here, and I'm so excited about commodity discs from commoditydiscs.com. They're one-ounce silver pieces with a QR code engraved on the backside. Scan the code with your phone and get the instant spot price. Commodity discs are paving the way forward for the alternative currency community in America and around the world. The QR code commodity disc. Technology has now finally made a real free market silver currency viable. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one free. That's commoditydiscs.com. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. And our next guest today is Dean Ahmad from the Minaret of Freedom. That's minaret.org, the website of the Minaret of Freedom Institute, calling the faithful to freedom, advocating a free market Muslim perspective on economics, democracy, terrorism, and the Middle East conflict. And, Dean, you've also been pretty active over the years with the Libertarian Party, right?
Yes, I have.
All right, good deal. Well, welcome back to the show. Thank you very much for joining us today. Good to talk to you again.
Always a pleasure.
Okay, great. So, I guess, first of all, forgive me for asking such a broad question to start off, but certainly you're well-equipped to answer it. What do you think that libertarians need to understand about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict?
Well, I think that the most important thing for libertarians to understand is the context and the history of the conflict, to realize that what we're talking about is a region where Muslims, Jews, and Christians had lived side by side for a very long time. Not without any problems, you understand. I'm not trying to idealize it, but with great success, and where people had there were many people who had property rights, and I think this is the most important thing for libertarians to understand about the area. Palestine, the area we call Palestine, which includes the occupied territories and Israel, consisted of mainly Muslims. But there was a very large 10 to 30% Jewish minority and a significant, maybe 10% Christian minority. Many of these people had title to the land they lived on. Those land titles of the area that is called Israel were held by on some majorities, about 93% of the privately held land was held by Muslim and Christian Palestinians. Only 7% was in the hands of Jews. And that since the State of Israel was established as a homeland for, not for the native Jews who already had their homes in Palestine, but for European Jews who were trying to flee the pogroms in Russia and this anti-Semitism in France, and of course later in the middle of the 20th century from the Nazis in Germany, that those people were being brought in and were trying to take over the land after the State of Israel was established, by means of confiscation. Before then, they'd been purchasing or renting land. Some of those land purchases might be questioned as being from absentee landlords, but let's set that aside, because that's not the main problem. The main problem is that through a variety of methods, the Israelis have taken land away from their actual owners and given title to, in most cases, the Jewish National Fund or the Israeli state, and in some cases to private Jewish owners, and that this is totally opposed to libertarian principles.
All right. Now, so that is important. But it's not the whole story either, because, well, or I don't know, maybe that is enough of the whole story for me to ask.
It's not
this.
The whole story.
I'm sorry. Sometimes I don't know quite how to form my questions here. But, you know, the crux of what I'm trying to get to, I guess, or what's interesting to me that I wonder if you can help solve here, is whether you think that, you know, even with that being the case, is it possible that, you know, just the fait accompli, even with the Nakba and all the rest, that Israel could possibly, I mean, they've gotten political agreement from various Palestinian authorities over the time, that they could really just go ahead and get away with being Israel, at least within 67 borders or maybe 48 borders, but that the real problem comes from the occupation of East Jerusalem and the West Bank and the Gaza Strip and maybe the Golan Heights since 1967. Or, you know, I wonder about what you think about all that one state, two state, and you know, as bad as all the violations of property rights were back in 1948, it seems like, you know, maybe we could find a compromise and go forward from here, and there could, you know, be an Israel and a Palestine, but I don't know. Mm-hmm. What do you think about that?
Sure. Well, if we're going to change our focus, we can look at the last maybe 20 or 30 years, and what we see is that ever since the Camp David Accords...
Mm-hmm. That would have been in 79, right?
Or 78? That's right. Most Palestinians have been willing to accept Israel as a fait accompli and set aside any questions or we have about its moral or legal legitimacy, and to say that as a means of moving forward and trying to reestablish peace in the region, let's allow Israel to exist more or less in its 67 borders, and let the Palestinians have their own state in Gaza and the West Bank, and let's have an agreement that the minority populations in both of these states will be treated with the decent respect of human rights that are understood to be entitled to under international law. Mm-hmm. This was the whole framework of the Camp David Accords, which proposed a direction for the solution of all but five the toughest issues, which were put off until later. Because one of the toughest of those tough issues was never addressed, however, there was really no chance of a workable solution being produced. That issue that I'm referring to is the question of the Palestinians' right of return. Mm-hmm. It's one thing to say you're going to have a Israeli state and you're going to have a Palestinian state and they're going to be decent in the way they treat their minorities and so on and so forth. This is all great. But the question is, what about the people who were driven out of their land? Are they allowed to come back? Now, the Israelis have always steadfastly and uncompromisingly held to the view that any Jew, even if he was driven from Palestine 2,000 years ago, of course, he wouldn't have been driven, his family would have driven out 2,000 years ago, should be allowed to return to Israel. Mm-hmm. But they have not been willing to allow those Palestinians who were driven out 50 years ago or 60 years ago or 40 years ago or 30 years ago to come back, or even some who have been driven out more recently from Jerusalem, to come back. Mm-hmm. But that right of return for those, certainly for those individuals who are still alive, and I would argue at least to some degree for their children, is something that's recognized in international law. It's something that the Palestinians couldn't negotiate away, even if they wanted to, and they don't want to.
Yeah. Well, you know, and that really gets to the absurdity of this whole question when I, for example, am just Jewish enough where I would qualify for a Nazi camp or to make Aliyah to Israel. Otherwise, I don't really have anything to do with Judaism and never have in my entire life. But just technically speaking, I could get on the dole and all kinds of things over there. Whereas you're actually from Palestine and you have no right to go back at all. It seems to me like they had their fait accompli, and yet by mistreating and using and abusing and getting away with the occupation all this time, that now they've sort of called into question whether it's even possible at all to have, quote-unquote nice guy Israel that got away with what they got away with but try to move forward in peace. Now, I think more and more people are going all the way back and questioning why it is that I can live in Israel, Dean, but you cannot. It's crazy.
Well, you know, not to put too fine a point on it, but I think that the most graphic representation of the problem was when the Israelis allowed a Jewish American who had never been to Israel and who had murdered a Hispanic person out here in Montgomery County in Maryland.
Real quick.
They allowed him into Israel on the grounds that as a Jew, regardless of what he had...
All right, I'm sorry, we got to go. Dean Ahmad, we'll be right back, y'all. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers. Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders, quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck.
Oh, man. Thought that was an old picture of the Oklahoma City bombing, but no, that's from Gaza. On my Twitter feed. All right. Talking with Dean Ahmad from the Minaret of Freedom. Calling the faithful to freedom. The Minaret Institute. Minaret of Freedom Institute. And, so we're talking about the Israel-Palestine issue and all that. And I wanted to be clear here real quick that I don't disavow Judaism any more than I disavow Anglicanism or whatever was from my father's side of the family or any of that. I don't believe in any of that. If I have a tribe at all, it's, you know, Anderson Mill neighborhood, skater punks, something like that. Otherwise, pretty much just me and my family is the way I look at it. So I don't have any other real allegiances than that. Other than to you guys, my audience, who try to bring good guests to talk with you about stuff. But anyway, I just want to be clear about that. And it is insane, by the way, that I have any property right in Israel whatsoever, and the Palestinians don't have the right of return. And you were mentioning this criminal, a murderer that they let in because, hey, he's Jewish, so they let in an American into Israel. These magical 2,000-year-old property rights even somehow apply to the scum of the earth as long as they're Jewish, even to murderers. So back to the fait accompli and the maybe blowing it thing. I always thought that, you know, if we could go back in time and Yitzhak Rabin had lived and there was a two-state thing and the international community helped all of the exiles and refugees settle at least in the West Bank and help develop the West Bank, and they were allowed to keep their water resources, whatever, that would be a raw deal, but that it would be more or less acceptable for going forward. And the politicians in the PLO have said that in the past and that kind of thing, that they're willing to stoop that low and accept it because what are you going to do? People want to live and go forward and all that. But since the Israelis have insisted on, in fact, stealing all of the West Bank and keeping the Palestinians as occupied helots in the way that they are right now, bombing the crap out of them to death every once in a while, every couple of years, the way they do with these repeated cast lead type punishments, collective atrocities, massacres. It seems like, nope, really, this is why Max Blumenthal and Philip Weiss and some of these other liberal American Jews have completely given up on Zionism at all. They're saying that the current occupations is basically... are basically part and parcel of the existence of Israel at all. They insist that it's this way, and this is why there can't be a Jewish state. It must be a one-state solution over there where everyone just has equal rights and leave all the theocracy and ethnic identity out of it, because even if they ever could have done it quote-unquote right as possible, they sure as hell haven't. Dean, and that's the way I'm looking at it now. Not that I have a dog in the fight, but just looking at it from an American who's sort of stuck in this fight because my government is paying for one side to slaughter the other all day. That's the way it seems to me, is it's time for everyone to just drop the pretense of two states, since those days are over now. What do you think?
Well, I think an increasing number of people are coming to the same conclusion. To me, the biggest change over the last couple of decades has not been in the relationship between the Israelis and the Palestinians. The changes there have been kind of marginal. The biggest change that I've seen has been in terms of the conversation or the discussion, the discourse about this issue within the United States. And the most important thing, you asked me earlier what's the most important thing for libertarians to understand. The most important thing for Americans to understand about what's going on, regardless of your political persuasion, about what's going on in the Middle East, is that the dispute in Palestine is not at all a religious dispute. The dispute is totally a land dispute. There is no attempt by Jews to convert Muslims to Judaism, and there's no attempt by Muslims to force Jews into becoming Muslims. It's got nothing to do with that. The question is, who has the rights to that land, both in terms of property rights, as libertarians would be concerned, and in a more general sense of self-determination, as other people are concerned about. If you're going to have a government, and of course, as libertarians, we can have interesting conversations about that question, but if you're going to have a government, it has to be with the consent of the governed. And so you have this land where the people there have not been allowed to govern themselves for a very, very long time. And the two-state solution offered, as you said, kind of an ad hoc, not the ideal solution, but look, here's a way you can have some self-determination. We'll let the people in the 67 borders continue to be Israel and continue to govern themselves, by a more or less democratic system, and we'll try to establish a more or less democratic system in the occupied territories. But look what happened. They allowed the people in the occupied territories, even though it continued to be occupied by the Israelis, but nonetheless, they allowed them to have an election and to elect their governors. So who did they elect? Well, partly because of ill-conceived American attempt to intervene in the elections, Hamas won. Even Hamas wasn't expecting the win. They were hoping to be a plurality and therefore be entitled to set up a coalition government. But instead, they won outright. Well, okay, fine, they win. Then what happens? The Fatah, with the encouragement of both Israel and the United States, tries to forcibly take over the government. In West Bank, they have no problem doing so, but in Gaza, they meet with violent resistance, and Hamas wins and maintains the government in Gaza. Now you no longer have a unified government. Now you've got a Fatah-appointed prime minister ruling the West Bank, and you have Gaza still being ruled by Hamas. What's outrageous is that you still see in the United States, I just saw a camera advertisement this morning in the Washington Post, I couldn't believe their nerve, saying that the current problem started because Hamas, despite a democratic election, took over Gaza. They're really forgetting that Hamas won the election? Kind of
and they even had a coalition, like you're saying. They didn't have to, but they agreed to have a coalition with Fatah until Elliot Abrams and Ehud Olmert and Hosni Mubarak funneled a bunch of guns to Fatah to kill Hamas with, to betray them with. Only it blew up in their face, of course, and only then did Hamas end up running the whole strip.
Yeah, so it's this kind of ignorance that has been the only reason that in the past the American public has sided with Israel. But what I find now for the first time, as you look at what's happening in Gaza and the reaction in the United States, it's split about 50-50. Now, some people would be depressed by that, saying, you know, how can you have such a massive violation of common decency, let alone human rights, in these massacres, and still people are divided half and half? Well, that's a big change from 20, 30 years ago when Israel could have done the same thing and had almost unanimous support from the American public.
Right. Yeah, it seems like the internet has really made a difference, too, when you look at the polls. I know I speak for other Americans on this, and my own ignorance being brought up, not with a pro-Israel narrative specifically, but just with the common narrative about the situation, and that is that we Americans are on the side of the Israelis, and you don't need to know much more about it than that. And certainly, they never explained that, well, back in the 67 war was the beginning of the occupation of these particular territories, and this is what it's like for the people in those territories ever since then. I know Americans used to not know that. Now they do. The younger and more online, the more they know about it, and their minds are changed. They're not going along with that old narrative because it doesn't hold up to scrutiny when you can really Google it and find out the details yourself.
Well, you're right about the influence of the online media, but I think there's another element, too, that should be acknowledged. You know, you made the disclaimer that despite some Jewish background, you don't identify as such. But the fact is many young Jews who in America who do identify as Jewish no longer feel that that identity requires them to support Israeli the Israeli state, let alone Israeli policies. And what you're seeing is a dividing line between younger and older Jewish Americans, where this unquestioning support for Israel is pretty much being relegated to the older generation, and younger people are becoming more and more willing to speak out, even on even on the social media. I think you mentioned Mondo Weiss. If you didn't, I'll mention it. That is a Philip Weiss is a young Jewish American who has a website with a lot of good information about what's going on in the Middle East. Stuff that you would had a hard time finding being mentioned other than by a handful of Jews. You know, people like Izzy Stone and Noam Chomsky, maybe. Mm-hmm. But
in
now
previous
things
generations,
are changing.
You mean?
In the previous generation, yeah.
Yeah, man, I'm so sorry that we're out of time. I sure would like to continue this conversation with you, Dean.
Oh, anytime.
Great.
I'd be glad to.
Let's try and catch up next week, then.
Okay.
Okay, great. That's Dean Ahmad, everybody. He's at minaret.org. That's the Minaret of Freedom Institute, calling the faithful to freedom, Islam, and libertarianism there. Minaret.org. Thanks for listening, everybody. That's it for the show. See you tomorrow.